Good afternoon, everybody. Nice crowd today, beautiful day, huh? Good weather. We just need it not to get any hotter and stop raining for a little while longer. Well, today I want to talk about fear, and its opposition, courage. Why? Because I really think we have to have the proper balance of both. I appreciated Mr. Sanders' sermonette a couple of months ago titled Counting the Cost. I've been thinking a lot about this subject of fear and courage for some time, going all the way back to the summer. Probably had a lot to do with building up my own courage to speak at the feast. But nevertheless, the subject had been on my mind. And Mr. Sanders' sermonette helped me bring it into focus. It brought it all together for me. If you remember, his goal was to get us to think about all that will be taking place as we head towards the last days, the challenges we might face, and most of all, to remember the commitment that we made to Jesus Christ. He didn't want us to come up short. He wanted us to be prepared. So with that in mind, I believe it's vital to learn how to deal with our fears so we can better understand courage. True Christians will increasingly become targets for hostility and mockery as we continue down this road that we're on. We're already seeing what can happen for standing up for your beliefs. There was a story I heard about, it's been 3 or 4 months ago. Maybe you heard about it. I think Mr. Sanderlin's mentioned it briefly once. But it was about a girl. She was a soccer player. She was an athlete who spoke up about a transgender person being in the locker room. So I decided to look a little further into the story. And here's what I found. She was a freshman. She was 14 years old. And her name is Blake. And this is what she had to say about the episode that took place. She said, "I was in the locker room and a trans student walked in and the rest of the team was in there. I was really uncomfortable and I left. I told the school and they just shut me down saying there was nothing they could do. I was later suspended because I voiced my opinion that a male shouldn't be in the women's locker room." Now, she ended up getting suspended not for speaking out against it, but because she misgendered the person. She ended up calling him a boy, and then I think she ended up referring to him as a dude later on in another post. But as incredible as it sounds, the story doesn't stop there. Blake was told to participate in a restorative justice circle. Now, I had no clue what a restorative justice circle was. Never heard of it, so I decided to look it up. Well, I got to tell you, when I looked it up, I lost 2 days. I spent at least 2 days down this rabbit hole trying to figure this out. It's an amazing study. It really is. And when you look at it, it's very eye-opening on all that's going on right now. But that's a story or a message probably for another day. But in a nutshell, I think this is a good definition. A restorative justice circle is an approach to repairing harm that has been done within a community. Participants in a restorative circle are encouraged to be open and honest about their perspectives regarding a conflict, how they've been harmed, and how they think others might have been harmed. Restorative justice, again, this is the approach to repairing harm, is often discussed in conjunction with transformative justice. Transformative justice is a series of practices and philosophies designed to create change in a social system. These two approaches to harm, again, restorative justice and transformative justice, share a foundation of centering the experience of the person that's been harmed and creating accountability. Now, the victim in this case is the transgender person. While restorative justice aims to repair the harm in the relationships the harmful acts have damaged, transformative justice seeks to transform the harmful structures that allowed the harm to occur in the first place. Now, on the surface, at least for me, when I first read this, I said, that sounds pretty biblical. This is before I jumped down into this rabbit hole. I said, that sounds right. You know, when you look at it, Jesus Christ tells us, if you go to the altar to leave your gift and remember you have something against your brother, first leave your gift, go be reconciled to your brother, and then come back and offer your gift. And then we're told if he won't hear you, bring one or two more with you, so every word might be established. So at first glance, you're thinking that's good, but there's a problem. There's a problem. That's assuming that you have a moral compass, and the world's moral compass is broken. And the result is the world's heading in the wrong direction, away from God. I mean, how can we even have a discussion about morality in the first place if God's left out of it? Anyways, Blake is considered the offender. hearing this. And this all happened in Vermont. And under Vermont education policy, transgender students are allowed to participate in sports and use restrooms and locker rooms that correspond with their gender identity, how they feel. Now, here's what the policy states. It says the use of restrooms and locker rooms by transgender students requires schools to consider numerous factors. A transgender student should not be required to use a locker room or restroom that conflicts with the student's gender identity. That's the school district stance. That's the policy. Now, the district allegedly demanded Blake Allen serve a 2-day out-of-school suspension, write a letter of apology to the student, as well as join this restorative justice circle with the school's equity teacher. Now, this equity teacher thing, again, this was all new to me. I've heard more about equity counselors than I've ever heard since I've looked into this story. Keep your ear open. It just seems to keep popping up and popping up. But it still doesn't stop there. With all that, they wanted her to have at least 2 students to help her understand the rights of the student to access public accommodations. Blake's reply, I'd rather have a 5-day suspension than to apologize because I'm just not sorry. It's hard for me to even believe. You know, what about Blake's rights? Where in all this are Blake's rights? You know, we were talking, or we weren't, Mr. Sanders was talking about that moral curve here, a week or two ago. And the moral curve has never been straight. It's always gone downhill since I've been around. But boy, it's fallen off a cliff. Fallen absolutely off a cliff in the last couple of years. And this is just, I hear stories from my children, from out there, and it's just hard to deal with. But this 2-step process, this restorative and transformative justice, is taking the world by storm. And it's eventually going to have ramifications for us all. It wasn't, a month ago when there was a hockey player who refused to wear a rainbow-colored jersey to support the LGBT community. He just said, it's against my religious beliefs. I think he was a Russian Orthodox Christian. He was absolutely ridiculed because he just didn't want to do it. It's crazy, but Blake's story doesn't even stop here. Blake's father was the soccer coach at the school. He, too, was disciplined. He was suspended for the season because he referred to the student as a boy in a social media post. Here's what that article had to say. It said, the next week the lawsuit claims the trans-identifying boy told others in his math class, I'm going to kill Blake Allen. That evening, someone identified as the mother of the boy in question stated on Facebook that Blake Allen made up the story for attention and that the truth would prevail. Now, Travis Allen, this is Blake's father, replied to the post, and this is what he had to say. He said, the truth is your son watched my daughter and other girls change in the locker room. While he got a free show, they got violated. The school district superintendent then allegedly said that Travis Allen had misgendered the transgender student and suspended him without pay for the rest of the season. All this is according to the lawsuit. Now, here's the thing. It goes even a little deeper. Travis Allen agreed not to use gender pronouns. But he did balk when they told him that they demanded that he issue a public apology. He said, when the school district superintendent asked me to publicly apologize, I thought about it. Allen said to the Daily Signal, I did pause and wait a few seconds, and I'm thinking, if I say that I'll apologize, I'll be able to coach my youngest daughter for the rest of the season. But I'm going to, in turn, hurt my other daughter because I'm not standing up for what I believe in. I'm just cowering down to them like so many other people have done. And I just can't do that. Now, for transparency reasons, after the lawsuit was filed, the school dropped Blake's suspension. The article said it was unclear if it was linked to the lawsuit or not. It's just hard to believe, though, isn't it? This is where we are right now. It's just where we are. Blake and Travis showed real courage under pressure. They did. This is the type of pressure I believe we're all going to be facing as the world continues on this moral downslide. I have no clue what Blake or Travis' belief system is. I have no idea. But what I do know is this is an example of counting the cost, what Mr. Sanders was trying to impress upon us, to get us to think about. It's also a sample of some of the courage we're going to need going forward. And I said some because I think we're going to need more than this as we continue down this road. But But, you know, I believe courage is like building muscle. You have to work at it. It doesn't just happen. Blake said her classmates had been supportive of her but had been too scared to speak out because of the backlash. They were with her. They just didn't want to get ridiculed like she did. Unlike Blake, her friends lacked the courage to stand up for what was right. They feared the backlash. And this is the kind of fear we must avoid. It can be deadly for us. And that's what I want to focus on today. I want to focus on fear and courage. Fear, if not managed, can paralyze us. It can make us freeze. You know, I used to preach to the kids when they were young, don't panic, don't panic. When you panic, rational thought goes out the window, you freeze, and then you're just stuck there and you don't know what to do. You know, we have to spend time thinking about certain things. I got a question. How many in this room right now, whether you have children or not, but especially with children, know what to do if that fire alarm goes off at 2 o'clock in the morning? Is it going to be like being struck in the eyes? You know, you're going to freeze? We need to know what to do. We need to be thinking about these things. We need to know how to get out of these kind of situations. We live around a lot of water. What do we do if our car goes into the water? We got to get those windows down. We got to get those doors open. These are all things we all need, especially me. I haven't talked about it since my children were little. Gary and I probably should have this discussion. 2 o'clock in the morning is not the time to worry about that. Training a plan prevents panic. Panic kills. It does. It kills. But you know, I think the biggest danger of fear is it can make us compromise our beliefs. It can keep us, you and me, from doing what we know to be right, what we know. And that can be deadly. That kind of fear has the potential to keep us out of the kingdom of God. Now, there's an interesting passage over in Revelation 21. I'd like to turn over to Revelation 21, verse 7 and 8, and take notice of this. Like I said, this is a very familiar passage. For me personally, it's one that since day one I've read it, it's kind of stuck with me. This whole order that's listed here has always just jumped out at me. But it's interesting. Let's have a look. It's Revelation 21, and we're going to just jump in and read verses 7 and 8. And Jesus Christ is speaking here. He said, "He who overcomes shall inherit all things, but the cowardly, the unbelieving, the abominable, the murderer, the sexually immoral, the sorcerer, the idolater, and all liars will have their part in a lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." Now notice the very first thing mentioned here is cowardly. Cowardly is the very first thing mentioned. The Greek word translated cowardly is delos, which means timid or fearful. Jesus Christ uses this word twice in the Gospels, once in Matthew 8 and once in Mark 4. If you remember the account, it was the account when the boat was being tossed in the Sea of Galilee. Remember, the wind kicked up, the water was coming in, and what happened? Jesus Christ was sleeping in the bottom of the boat, but the disciples started to panic, and the disciples woke up Jesus Christ. And you remember what Christ's reply was? He said, why were you fearful? Why were you fearful? That word fearful is the word delos, which we just talked about. But Jesus Christ didn't stop there. He followed it with, "You of little faith." Or in Mark, "How is it that you have no faith?" So really, this kind of fear could also be said that you have little faith. Something really interesting to note. I've never noticed this. I paid attention to it until I was doing this. But what's the second thing listed in that list? It's unbelieving. Unbelieving. The word for unbelieving can be translated unfaithful or faithless. It brings on the meaning without trust. And in their case, without trusting God. When you're unbelieving, when you're lacking faith, you disbelieve God. And let's face it, what are we really saying at that point? To God, "I really don't think you are who you say you are. I really don't believe you'll do what you say you will do." I mean, that's kind of what we're saying. Fear can be a slippery slope. It really can. But if having any kind of fear could keep us out of the kingdom of God, then we all might need have the courage to bungee jump off a high building and swim with sharks. Conquering those natural fears isn't what God cares about. It's not what he cares about. Common fears aren't going to keep anybody from being a member of the God family. I mean, let's face it. I am scared to death to climb on the back of a 1,500-pound bull with a bad attitude. I don't see it as fear, but common sense. That's a good thing. We have to have fear if we're going to survive this life. Fear is an emotion. It's an emotion. It's an unpleasant, often strong emotion caused by the anticipation or awareness of danger. That can be a good thing, though. Life without fear could mean a quick death. Fear can keep us doing from something stupid, though, can't it? Like climbing on the back of that bull or touching a hot burner. It's a good thing. On the other hand, fear can prevent us from standing up for what's right, for obeying God. And that's a bad thing. You know, it's been said, and I read this, I like this quote, it's fear is a reaction, courage is a decision. If that's true, how we react is going to affect our decision, isn't it? We must learn how to react to fear. We have to. And that brings us to another fear we have to talk about. And that's the fear of God. The fear of God is the key to courage. It is the absolute key. The fear of God teaches us how to react to our human fears. It enables us to make correct decisions. In other words, to find the courage we'll need when the time comes. So what is the fear of God? How does the Bible define it? Well, I think Psalm 128 has about the best and simplest definition we're going to find. So if you would, let's turn to Psalm 128, verse 1. Like this definition, it's plain, it's simple. It's straight and to the point, really, at the end of the day. Psalm 128, verse 1. It says, blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. Now, the New King James Study Bible has this to say about Psalm 128, 1. It says, the fear of God is an attitude of respect, a response of reverence and wonder, and it's the only appropriate response to our Creator and Redeemer. Okay. So the fear of the Lord is having a deep respect and reverence for God's power and authority. A proper fear of the Lord leads us to love Him, believe in Him, trust in Him. You know, I always turn to Life, Hope, and Truth. It seems like every article I quote Life, Hope, and Truth, and it's in there. Such a great resource. And this one's no different. I found an article titled, What Does the Fear of the Lord Mean? I think Mike Bennett wrote it, but I didn't write it down. I don't remember. But it was an excellent article, and it made me think about it in a little different way. Kind of like a diamond with a facet and a diamond. I just saw it in a different light, and it really was amazing to me. Anyways, he had this to say. He said, rather than a paralyzing terror, the positive fear of the Lord taught in the Bible is a key element in change. He said, it helps us have a proper and humble perspective of ourselves in relationship to our awesome God. It helps us in times of temptation when we need to remember the serious consequences of disobeying God. And it motivates us to become more like our loving Creator. That's right, right? Let's face it. Christians don't start out as spiritually fearless. We don't. That's not who we are. We don't begin as the mighty or wise of the world. We're usually the weak and the fearful of the world. At least that's what 1 Corinthians 1:26 tells us. Now, allow me to read 1 Corinthians 1:26, but if you would, be turning to Romans 12:2, because we're going to turn to Romans 12:2 in just a second. But this lets us know. It says, for you see your calling, brethren, not many wise are called according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. We're called to change or be transformed. Romans 12:2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you might prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. We are called to be overcomers. That's what we're called to do. We're called to change and overcome. The mere fact that we're called to overcome means we will face challenges. We will have trials. And we will face fear. All part of it. To overcome, we must believe what God is who He says He is and will do what He says He will do. Now, I'd like to take a minute and look at a couple of I am statements followed by some I will statements from God. I think this is just so crucial in the whole mix of courage. We just have to have this down. We all know that one of the names of God is I Am. We know that from Exodus 3, when Moses was at the burning bush talking to God, right? This is a really good scripture. But if you would turn to Exodus 3, and we're going to read 13 and 14. I want to put eyes on this, because we all know when we get to John 8:58, Jesus Christ lets us know he is the I Am. I mean, he just brings us right back to this. So Exodus 3, verses 13 and 14 says, "Then Moses said to God, 'Indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them?' And God said to Moses, 'I am who I am.' And he said thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you.'" You know, when we get to Exodus 22 and 3, we all know this one by heart too, the first commandment. And it's also the beginning of our relationship with God, really, when you think about it. What's God say? "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me." We understand that God delivered us. We understand that Egypt is a type of sin, and God delivered us from the bondage of sin, death. That's what God does. He delivers. He did that. I got a question. Who can stop him? Can anybody stop him? Well, we know in Jeremiah 32:27, God told Jeremiah, "I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me?" No. There's nothing too hard. Nothing's impossible for God. Jesus Christ himself reaffirms this over in Mark 10, verse 27. He told us, with God, all things are possible. This has to be firmly planted in our mind. There is no greater, there's nobody that can thwart anything that God sets out to do. Satan himself, nobody. Now I'd like to turn to Isaiah 41 and verse 8. And these are some remarkable scriptures with incredible promises. These can be applied directly to us. We need to own these scriptures. We need to own them. I've turned to these scriptures a lot here lately in the last couple of years, and they bring incredible comfort. It's Isaiah 41, and we're going to start in verse 8. It says, "You, Israel, are my servant, Jacob, who I have chosen, the descendants of Abraham, my friend." Now, one of our fundamental beliefs are the promises to Abraham. We understand that there's promises that come down through them. There's the physical promises. We look at Great Britain and the United States in prophecy. But we also understand the spiritual side of this. We're part of that spiritual side. We can own this. We understand this. It continuing in verse 9, he says, "You whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from its furthest regions." Look at that international leadership program. I think right now the Horchaks and the Franks and all are in South Africa, correct? They have gone to the four corners of this earth, to put it, to talk to the servants, to lead, and to raise up leaders. I mean, it's just incredible. "And he said to you, 'You are my servant.'" Put your name there. We need to own it. "You are my servant, Patrick. I have chosen you and I have not cast you away." That is amazing to think about. It's amazing. When we go back to Mr. Sandlin's sermon series on the wedding supper, it was such an incredible thing to think about. I don't know if I've ever thought as deep about it as I have since then. But God himself chose us. He chose me. He chose you to be in a marriage-type relationship with his son, Jesus Christ. I mean, that is just incredible. There is no greater relationship, physical and spiritual, than the marriage relationship. It's all about the beginning of the family. There's so much that goes into it. Yet God decided that we were worthy of that calling. But like Mr. Sandlin's pointed out, we have a job to do. We have a job to do. We must be preparing now. We must grow. We must be transformed. Just like Romans 12:2 tells us. Not like the world tells us. If we listen to the world, the world looks at transformative justice with all its series of practices and philosophies to create change in a social system. In other words, to change the minds of its governing systems is what it's really saying. Satan is the ruler of this world, and the battle is a battle for our minds. Let me think back to Blake for a minute. What did they want Blake to do? They took two of her peers, and they wanted to make her understand where her thinking was wrong. But Paul tells us, or more accurately put, God tells us through Paul, don't be conformed to this world. Instead, be transformed by the renewing of our minds, that we might prove what is the good, acceptable, and perfect will of God, not the world. The world, Satan, uses fear to make people cow down. That's what happened. That's what this cancel culture is all about, isn't it? Conform or be destroyed. That's your choices. But the key to controlling fear is believing in God, trusting in God. With that said, let's continue in Isaiah 41 in verse 10. And look what God says, has to say. How does he tell us to react? Fear not, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed. I am your God. I mean, how awesome is that? That is incredible. Now look at the I will statements. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Behold, all those who are incensed against you shall be ashamed and disgraced. They shall be as nothing. And those who strive against you shall perish. You shall seek them, but you won't find them. Those who contend with you, those who war against you, shall be as nothing, as a non-existent thing. Why? For I, the Lord your God, will hold your right hand, saying to you, fear not, I will help you. Fear not, you worm Jacob, you men of Israel. He knows we're of low esteem. He knows we're low and weak. He says, I will help you, says your Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. That's our God. Better than that, that's our Father. That is our Father. He will help, and he does deliver. That's what he does. We're in a fight for our minds. It is a war. And by definition, the world wants us to cow down to fear. I mean, Satan, and by definition, the world wants us to cow down to fear. If you won't do that, being canceled or destroyed is your only other option. On the other hand, God is consistently telling us to fear not, isn't he? You ever stop and think about that for a minute? Why is he always telling us to fear not? He obviously knows we're afraid, but he's telling us to fear not. Because there has never, ever been a battle or a war fought and won where fear is dominated. I didn't say fear wasn't there, but fear certainly didn't dominate and take hold of everybody. Winning, overcoming, takes courage. It takes courage. But you know, at the surface, you might think, wow, if I only had enough courage, I wouldn't be afraid. Yeah, that sounds good, right? Except courage is doing what you're afraid to do. There can be no courage unless you got fear. In other words, the less fear exists is the only way there can be courage. But make no mistake about it, there is a difference between fear and cowardice. Fear, we already talked about, it's an emotion, but cowardice is a trait, and a trait can become part of your character. Cowardice is described as excessive fear that can prevent an individual from taking a risk or facing danger. A coward is someone who lacks the courage to face his fears. And that's a category we don't want to be in. But here's the best thing. That's a category we don't need to be in. God doesn't want us in it. God tells us not to do it. We don't have to be in this category. We really don't. Nelson Mandela is credited for this quote. He said, I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear. Did you catch that? Interestingly, he said, I learned. He said, I learned. That's how this works, isn't it? We don't just wake up one day and become courageous. It doesn't work that way. We're not baptized and become champions of faith overnight. It's not how it works. God always starts off small. Look at the mustard seed. It gets a mustard seed, and it grows until it becomes a tree. We don't start out as the weak of the world, but that's not where God wants us to stay. The fear of God should lead us to change, to be transformed. It's not mere knowledge God wants. It's not just knowledge, but it's growth, it's action, it's faith. Think about this for a minute. I read this and I had to stop and think about it for a little bit. It says, it doesn't matter how much of God's truth you possess if you don't have the courage to act upon it. It's true, isn't it? We can have all the knowledge in the world, but if we don't want to do anything with it, if we don't have the courage to stand up for it, it's useless. The key to courage is believing in something. It's faith. If you don't fully believe the cause you're fighting for, or maybe I should say standing up for, when the times get tough, you'll just walk away. You're just going to, boop, walk away. But here's the funny thing. It's through the initial action of courage that faith in God is developed in the first place anyways. We have to make that step to develop it. Over in James chapter 1, verses 2 and 4, we're going to turn there. I think every one of us have been to this, especially when we've been in a trial or been around a trial. It seems we always turn to James chapter 1. But I'd like to look at this. I want to read this from the ESV version. The New King James version uses patience, but the ESV uses steadfast. And I read something interesting in Webster's. It had this to say about steadfastness. It says, steadfast has held its ground for many centuries. Its old English predecessor, steadfast, combined steed, meaning place or stead, and fast, meaning firmly fixed. The word was first used, and get this, in battle context to describe a warrior who stood his ground. It gave it its unmovable sense, which led way to giving the word use as an adjective to imply unwavering faith, loyalty, and devotion. Now, I want to read James 1, 2 verses 4, but allow me to read it in the ESV version and give me just a little bit of liberty to add some thought in. I'm not going to change anything it says, but I do want to interject thought into it. James 1, verse 2, it says, count it all joy, my brethren, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, like a warrior who stands his ground. And let that steadfastness have its full effect, unwavering faith, loyalty, and devotion. Why? That you might be able, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. That's awesome. I love the way that reads, and I like the picture it paints in my mind. And when we look at Ephesians 6:10, which we can turn to 6:10 real quick, with this whole warrior mentality in our mind, it fits perfectly. Because that's what we're in. This is a war. Again, we are in a battle. Ephesians 6, verse 10. It says, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. In the I am. In the I am. Put on the whole armor of God. Why? That you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of this dark age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. Therefore, or because of this, take up the whole armor of God, that you might be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Not only to stand, but stand with unwavering faith, loyalty, and devotion. Stand, therefore, having girded your waist with truth, putting on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. But above all, take the shield of faith, the eye wells. Take the eye wells with you, which you will be able to quench the fiery darts of the wicked one. And take the helmet of salvation, the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit. Again, make no mistake about it. This is a war we're in. It's a spiritual war that must be fought with spiritual weapons. We're warriors, aren't we? I mean, Paul tells us to put on the whole armor of God. Suit up. Battle alarms. Get battle ready. Why? That we might be able to stand. To stand against Satan and all his trickery. You know, it's through testing that we learn to stand our ground, to become good soldiers. Let's use the United States for a minute. We don't send our soldiers into battle unprepared. Every single one of them has to go through at least boot camp. That's the beginning of their training. They all receive the training, so they will learn in high-pressure situations how to react to fear. To always fall back on their training. Now, I was never in the military, but I was in the fire department, and I did go through their boot camp, and the same principles applied. You were put under stress to see how you would react. We're going way back, 40 years back, but I think it was 2 weeks. We took 2 weeks and they put us in classroom training and we went through all the classroom training. You know, you learn about fire, you learn about everything that goes on. And then you put through a series of tests at the end. And the last thing we went through, excuse me, was the smokehouse. Now, anybody that's ever crossed the Huey P. Long Bridge and you look to the side, that's Jefferson Parish Fire Training Academy. There's a little brick building down, or it's a cement building. That's the one I'm talking about. But what they did is they would bring everybody out, and they put hay was all in the house, and it was dampened, so it put off a lot of smoke, and it was hot. And you would take your glove off before you went in, and you would put your hand in the bottom of the window, and the instructor said, lift your hand up. And you'd lift your hand up, and then you'd get up so high, and it burned the hair on the back of your hand. And he'd say, keep your nose to the ground. So what they do is they put you in the smokehouse, you get your back against the door, and there's trainers in there. You can hear them. They have respirators on, not you. And this is something to remember, too. I'm going to point this out. It's just in case that alarm goes off at 2 o'clock in the morning. If you're in a house and you wake up and you're disoriented and it's full of smoke, keep your nose to the ground. That heat level is up there, and when you stand up, it extends your lungs, and it's game over. Also, what you do is you put the back of your hand against the wall. Doesn't matter, right or left, pick. Put the back of your hand, not the palm. Because if you hit an open circuit, your hand will pull away. If your palm's against the wall, you'll grab the electrical circuit and most probably be killed. So you put the back of your hand to the wall, and you follow the wall until you come to an exit. A window that's low enough that you can get out, or a door, and you get out. We were going through, you couldn't see, we couldn't breathe, it was awful. I could hear the instructors, and that's what they would tell us. Stay low, stay calm, remember your training. God puts us in stressful situations too. He really does. Not to break us, but to strengthen us. That's what it's all about. Think about all the times you might have doubted God, whatever the case may be, but you gathered the courage to trust him. Maybe it was a Sabbath issue. Maybe it was a holy day. I don't know. Whatever the case is, whenever God responded faithfully, you grew in courage. Every time you make the hard, correct decision, you become a bit more courageous. We're put in these situations so we can grow, and courage is a big part of that growth. Big part of that growth. And we always have to fall back on our training. That's the number one thing. Like we heard before, we're learning right now. That's what we're doing. What did Nelson Mandela say? We're learning that courage is not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it, the overcoming it. The brave servant isn't the one who doesn't feel afraid, but he who overcomes that fear. And we do that by trusting God. That's the only way it can really be done. You know, we heard Mr. Carlo's fourth quarter message here last month. And it was titled, Will Experience Shape Your Faith? Will Faith Shape Your Experience? It was an excellent sermon. I loved it. But he made this statement. He said, are we going to let our fear shape our faith, or are we going to let our faith shape our fear? The key to courage is the latter half of that statement. Our faith must shape our fear. The fear of God gives us the courage to overcome what? The fear of the world. Or the fear of Satan. Look what God told Joshua two times. The first chapter of Joshua is another one I always turn to when you want to hear something about courage. I mean, he was told so many times in the first chapter of Joshua. But God told him twice, be strong and courageous. He told him once, be strong and very courageous. And the people told him once, hey, be strong and very courageous. I mean, he was told over and over again. We are not alone in this. We don't. Great men and women down through history have all had fear and suffered fear. Look at Esther. At the threat of death, she went in and saw the king. She chose courage. She believed in God. We can never forget that courage isn't the absence of fear. It's the overcoming. We're called to overcome and win. We look at all the letters to the churches in Revelation. They're there to encourage us. They're there to give us strength, to correct us. But that's what we're called to do. We're called to overcome. We're called to win. I titled this message today, Courage to Fear, because that's what we're going to need. We've all chosen this path, every one of us. It's built on faith, faith in God. We were all told to count the cost, every single one of us. And you know what? We did. And we decided to fear God, to follow God. It's time for all of us to take courage and continue to learn and grow, learn how to react to the fear that the world's going to throw at us. None of us, and I mean nobody, is without fear. We're all still in training. There's some pretty battle-hard people in here. There's some generals that are sitting in here. But every single one of us is still in training. We're still learning and we're still growing. We must be prepared and be ready. But most of all, fear not. God is with you and will never leave you or forsake you.